Hello and welcome to episode number 2 of the Dow of Tech podcast. I am your host, Mark Prestash. The Dow of Tech is going to be your weekly dose in the way of technology. Episodes will be featuring the weekly geeky goings-on of your host, me, Mark Prestash. Today's show is going to be focusing on software. Recently, I had the pleasure of finishing my taxes, and I didn't finish them until, about 12:30 in the morning. And I had a lot of caffeine running through me at that particular point in time, so I knew there was really no way in hell that I was going to be going to sleep anytime in the near future. So I decided to start putzing around, and I had remembered reading a few stories online about new pieces of software that do this and do that, and I thought to myself, well, you know, what the hell, may as well start to try some of these pieces of software out and check them out and see if there were anything I wanted to integrate into my daily computing life. So that really is the genesis of this episode of the Dow of Tech. So now that you know the background of where the episode originated from, let's get into it. So I'm going to be talking about, I think, 7 or 8 different pieces of software here. And a lot of them I had to download, the pieces of software from the websites. And most of them came as a zip file. And for the longest time, I had have been using ZipGenius to satisfy all of my zip file needs. And I like ZipGenius quite a bit. It's a very nice looking piece of software. It's a very I guess the best way to describe it, it's very Windows XP-ish in its style. You know, sort of big buttons, very easy to figure out. You know, what the files, or I should say, what the buttons do to the file, and where to put them, and how everything works. And really for my needs, which really I are probably pretty basic as far as zip files go. I really just need them to open up zip files for executables and whatever else. I don't really do a whole lot of zip archiving or anything else. So for me, ZipGenius worked fine. The problem that I had ran across this one long night of software installations and trials was that ZipGenius started to fail on me. And what would happen would be, you know, I would download something, open up ZipGenius, it would open up the file just fine, it would export it to wherever I wanted it to go to, but when it came time to close ZipGenius, the application would hang on me, and it wouldn't close. You know, I tried to exit out, wouldn't close. I tried to close it from the taskbar. When I had to do a Control-Alt-Delete to bring up the task manager to actually kill the program from inside the task manager. And this happened to me 3 or 4 times over the course of the night. And I actually uninstalled it and I reinstalled it a couple more times, and it's still what was happening to me. And the version that I was using was version 6.3.0.240. And that is the most recent version that I am aware of. I actually got this from download.com. Looks like the file was added January 22nd of 2010. Let me just see real quick if there is a newer version of ZipGenius here real quick. Let's see. No, I keep on getting the January 22nd. So I believe that is the most recent version of the application there. Like I said, I've been using ZipGenius for a while, and so I was really kind of surprised that I was having the problems with ZipGenius that I was having. And I know that, you know, I'm running Windows 7, and I know that Windows 7 does a pretty good job at opening and extracting zip files, but you know, for those cases where it can't use it, sometimes I just like to have that standalone application that does something for me. So I actually ended up going back to my old default zip program, which wasn't WinZip. It was actually a program called 7-Zip. And while 7-Zip is not quite as graphically nice looking as ZipGenius is, it works nonetheless. it's more of a like a Windows 98-ish kind of style looking to it. But it does the job quite nicely. And, you know, I ended up using 7-Zip for the rest of the night for all of these files that I was downloading and extracting and you know, for all these the software that I was playing with this one long night. Now, let's see here. You don't need to register or pay for 7-Zip, which is real nice. Same thing with Zip Genius. It's totally free. For packing and unpacking, it supports 7Z, Zips, G-Zips, B-Zip2s, and TARs. Let's see, for unpacking, it does, gosh, it's got to be 12 or 15 different file formats. You can definitely try out Zip Genius. I'm just going to warn you that you may have that same problem that I had. If you want to try out Zip Genius, just go to download.com or Google Zip Genius, and you should find it there. If you're interested in 7-Zip, which is, like I said, the more stripped-down but fully functional version of Zip File Archiver and Unzipper, you can just go to www.7-zip.org and download it there. And both of these programs, I'm running the 64-bit version of Windows 7. They, as far as I remember, they do support both the 32 and 64-bit versions of the Windows OS's. Looks like they go back to Windows 95 as far as supported operating systems go on Zip Genius. And 7-Zip, it doesn't really say specifically which operating systems it supports, but like I said, I'm running Windows 7, and 7-Zip is fairly old. I was using it back in the Windows XP days, so I would, you know, suspect that most people are probably running Windows XP at the very least on their systems, if not Vista or Windows 7. So I think both of those programs would be a worthy choice for your zip file needs for packing and unpacking and creating zip files. So definitely give 7-Zip and or Zip Genius a try, with just that little caveat on Zip Genius that it may not quite work as promised. It may hang on you, you know, if you try it and you like it, but it hangs. Definitely give 7-Zip a check out and see what it does for you. Now, I was doing a lot of installations and uninstallations of files this one long night of the software here. What I was using to remove these unwanted applications and pieces of software was a little app called Revo Uninstaller. It's R-E-V-O Uninstaller, U-N-I-N-S-T-A-L-L-E-R. I like it a lot, but there's a caveat that will come at the end of a Revo Uninstaller. Now, Revo Uninstaller can be found at www.revouninstaller.com, so it's pretty much the name says it all right there. And they have a freeware version and a professional version, which ties into the caveat a little bit later on. What I liked about it is that it has a very beautiful GUI. It just, you know, you install it, you run it, and it brings up the most recently pieces of installed software on the very top line. And then below that, it gives you a list of all the quote-unquote other software that's installed on your PC. Now, you may ask, why use a standalone application to uninstall software from your PC when there's obviously a built-in uninstaller in Windows? The reason why I use it just seems like Windows always leaves something behind. There's always a folder, a file, a registry setting. There's always just something left behind there. And I don't know whether that's Windows or if that's just poorly written code on the uninstaller from the software vendor side. I just don't know, but it just always seems like there's something left behind. And what I like about Revo Uninstaller is that once you tell it to uninstall a piece of software, it does the uninstallation, but then it runs a secondary check, and it double checks to make sure that there are no folders or files or extensions or DLLs that are left behind once the uninstallation has been completed. And I've used this on things like iTunes. So iTunes, my God, I mean, if you run iTunes, you know how many freaking files and folders that iTunes creates. And, you know, when you install it, and if you've ever uninstalled it, you know it never actually uninstalls itself. It always leaves folders and files and other crap behind. So the nice thing about Revo is that it'll go in and detect those files, and for the most part, it gets rid of them, you know, from your system better than either Windows or the iTunes uninstaller actually does for you. So that's why I tended to use Revo uninstaller. Now, the nice thing is that there's a free version and there's a paid version. The free version also comes with an autorun manager, a junk file remover. It gives you a tool section that gives you some information on your PC. Also gives you a browser cleaner, but it only lists IE, Opera, and Netscape. No Firefox, which is pretty odd, I thought, considering how, you know, Firefox has almost 30% browser penetration, so it sort of seems a miscue, in my opinion, for Revo uninstaller to not include the Firefox browser cleaner. It's a pretty small application. I think it created something like an 18 megabyte folder on my PC, so that's nothing terribly large. So it's you know, it's pretty small in size, which is nice too. Something I haven't tried out but could possibly come in handy is a little feature they call the Evidence Remover. It's a feature where it, according to the manufacturer, the feature permanently erases things that have been put into your recycle bin. Now, I'm not sure if you know this or not, but when you move something into the recycle bin, it isn't actually deleted from your PC. It's just moved to a space on the disk where it can be overwritten. So it's no longer being protected. It's just, either the bit slip and they say, yep, this part can be rewritten now, or it gets put into another space on the hard drive where it can and will be overwritten if the time and the need comes. So it's nice to have that functionality if you want to, you know, have something that's been recycled to be permanently removed from your PC. They say it's impossible to recover. Like I said, I've never tried it, but it could come in handy someday. So, I mean, I tend to use other things for file deletion. I use a program called Super Shredder that does that, and it does a Department of Defense grade wipe on the hard disk for the offending file. You can tell it to wipe one time, five times, 10 times, 100 times, as many times as you want, and it'll essentially write random zeros and ones over the data, effectively rendering it impossible to recover. But again, you know, it's nice to have this sort of thing built into one program. Now, here's the caveat on Revo uninstaller. If you are running a 64-bit version of your operating system, you can only download a 30-day trial of the professional version. After that, they're going to ask you for a license key, and if you don't have one, it's not going to work. If you're running a 32-bit version of your operating system, then you can download the free version, and as far as I'm aware of, it's totally free, and they should never ask you to pay or ask for a license key or anything else. I don't have any recommendations for a 64-bit operating system for this kind of software. I will definitely keep my eyes open. If anything comes up, I will definitely pass that along to you guys, because it seems to work very well. It's a shame that the 64-bit version is only a piece of trialware. It's not free like the 32-bit version is, so I'm not quite sure why, but that's what they have done. Now, the next piece of software that I decided to download is a little thing called Desktops. And what Desktops is it's a virtual desktop application for Windows 7. Now, prior to this, I had been using an application in Windows XP that did the exact same thing. I want to say, though, that it only gave you two desktops a la Ubuntu, but Desktops for Windows 7, oh, it was PowerToys, that's what it was. The Windows XP virtual desktops application was one of the Windows Power Tools. This is not a Power Tool, as far as I'm aware of. Desktops is actually found at http://. technet.microsoft.com/en-us/sysinternals, SYSINTERNALS. And just go into the the miscellaneous category. There should be categories on the left hand side. There's file and disk utilities, networks, processes, security, system information utilities, and miscellaneous utilities. Go into the miscellaneous utilities, and the file is it's about halfway down the screen, right after debug view. It kind of goes in alphabetical order, so that's kind of easy to figure out. A small little application, 60 kilobytes. Really, really small. And the beautiful thing about what desktops does is it adds a 4-pane virtual desktop view to your PC. So once you install the software, you can either assign hotkeys like the F1, F2, F3, or F4 to do the switching on your desktops, for the different virtual desktop views, or you can do what I do and use the Alt plus 1, plus 2, plus 3, or plus 4 buttons to select the desktop that you want. You can also select the desktop that you want to view from the system tray, but I don't find that to be... I mean, you can do it, don't get me wrong. I don't particularly care to do it because you have to... It's more clicking. You have to, bring up the system tray, and then click on the desktop's little icon, and then it brings up, like a 4-pane preview, and then you have to click which one you want. I definitely find that the Alt 1, 2, 3, 4, just bam, 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 you can just quickly scroll through them and figure out which one you want to, to view and to use. Like I said, I've been using this for... Gosh, I'm going to be going on a month and a half to 2 months now, and I just fucking love this thing. It's just great. Really, if you're a multitasker, it's nice because you can separate your desktops into different tasks. For example, as of the recording of this podcast, desktop one is my browser, where I actually have all the tabs open for the software that I'm going to be talking about. Tab two is iTunes, just because to have it open, I'm charging my iPod, so it's open. Desktop 3 is the actual desktop where my recording software and the script for the show are actually being displayed. And Desktop 4, I tend to use that as like a miscellaneous, sort of like a dump desktop, if you will. It's for, file transfers or double-checking on something or whatever. I do use it often, but more often than not, I tend to use it more as a dump desktop for, say when I want to go into a folder or look for something, whatever, I tend to go into the fourth desktop for that. Now, some things that you can't do, you can't drag and drop from one desktop to another. So you can't drag, say, an image from desktop one to desktop four. As far as I know, there aren't many virtual desktops that can do that. I know that you can do it in Ubuntu, and I'm not sure about Safari if you can do it in in OS X. I'm not sure if you can do it there. The other thing is that it looks like you should be able to change the desktop backgrounds for the four different desktops, but I can't figure out how to do it. It's I can get desktop one set, and I'll set desktop two. And then desktops 2, 3, and 4 generally will show whatever I've set for desktop 2. If I change the desktop background in desktop 3, desktops 2, 3, and 4, again, will also change the desktops to reflect that desktop. That was one of the nice things about the desktop power toy for XP. It was a built-in function where you could... change the backgrounds for your different desktops. It was nice. It's a nice visual cue, I think, to differentiate your desktops. So that's one little two little caveats, I guess. So again, like I said, I fucking love this thing. I find it phenomenally useful for multitasking. For if I'm writing a document and I want to go online for something, it just Alt 1 for my browser desktop. Find what I'm looking for, copy it, Alt 3 into my document, paste it into there, bing, bang, boom, no fuss, no muss. It's nice to be able to leave the the application and the things open so that when you switch back and forth between the desktops, it's open, that whatever it is that you're using is open and ready to go and ready to use. Now again, if you're interested in desktops, you can go to /technetmicrosoft.com/en-us/sysinternals. So I definitely recommend desktops for people that that are the multitaskers that are out there. So the next thing that I downloaded and was trying out is something called Firefox Portable. And I had wanted a browser on my USB drive to use at work. I wanted to plug it to my laptop or plug it into the desktop at work, so the browsing history would be on the USB drive and not actually on the laptop or the desktop that I was using. I wanted to sort of cover my tracks, if you know what I'm saying. So I was kind of poking around the net, and I ultimately stumbled across and installed a portable version of Firefox called Firefox Portable, which can be found at http://portableapps.com/apps/internet. Now, the Firefox version, it was a 9 megabyte download. I mean, again, minuscule. You just download the file, make sure, you know, plug in your USB drive, install the application onto the USB drive, and that's it. You're ready to go. Now, you may say to yourself, well, you know, hey, Mark, I've got, you know, lots of bookmarks or my settings, the way the layout of my browser, I want to retain that, and you can. So the next thing you should probably download after you download and install Firefox Portable is a little thing called Fave Backup, and you can download that from favebrowser.com/backup. So favebrowser.com/backup. And what Fave Backup does is it backs up your current browser settings. Works on Firefox, works on Internet Explorer. I believe it also works on a couple of other browsers. I think it works on Opera, and I'm not sure about Safari or anything. Or I believe it works for Chrome too, but I use Firefox, so we're really going to focus on that. So really, all you do is once you have Fave Backup installed, you run it. You tell it that you want to back up your current Firefox profile, and then you tell it where you want to save that. Now, what it saves is it gets all of your settings, your extensions, your bookmarks, and your passwords, and it saves it all into one file. And then what you do is you can then use Fave Backup to import those settings and passwords and bookmarks onto the Firefox Portable version of Firefox. And now your portable version of Firefox looks exactly like your desktop version of Firefox. And it's just beautiful. It just bang, bang, boom, it just works. The only things that that didn't transfer over were FoxyTunes and the Google toolbar. Those did not come over when I imported my my settings from Firefox into the Firefox Portable version. But those are easy. I mean, you know, once you're in there, you can just download those add-ons and you know, or whatever else. I mean, there may be other things that for whatever reason don't work or don't quite transfer over like you would want them to. You know, once you're using the Firefox Portable, it's just, you know, you can add the add-ons just like you would at any other point in Firefox. You just go onto the extensions or the add-on page and you can install it and you're done. I did notice that Firefox Portable does run kind of slow. It's not the speediest thing I've ever seen in my life. It seems to take a little while to actually load and get going. I have a brand new USB drive. It's a Patriot. It's 8 gigabytes USB flash drive. It's brand new, so it should be pretty fast, and it's still slow there. So I think I don't know whether it's Firefox Portable that's just a little slow. I don't know if it's just the fact that it's going from USB to the internet and then from the internet back to the USB. I don't know if it's a data transfer issue that slows it down. It's not going to win any speed contests, but for what it's good for, which is, you know, sort of privately browsing on a machine, you know, if you're say on a library computer or a friend's computer, you know, you don't have to leave your tracks on that machine. It's also nice too because if you're trying to help out a buddy or somebody else, and you know, you're trying to, oh, you know, what was that website? Oh, what's that thing? You know, your bookmarks and your extensions, I mean, they're all there with you. So it's very easy to pull those things up and just click away like you normally would, like you were at home, and do whatever that you have to go and do. So if you don't want to try Firefox Portable, I understand 100%. It may not be for everybody, but I highly recommend everybody go out and try Fave Backup. It's one of those things where if you have to reinstall an operating system, you back up your browser, you just do a basic reinstall of your browser and import everything back in, and you're ready to go in like 2 minutes. I mean, it's just that easy. And it's good to have that just in case anything gets corrupted or for any number of reasons. It's always good to back stuff up, and backing up your browser is something that, with all the extensions and add-ons and tweaks that I've done to my browser, it's definitely something that I have been doing on a much more regular basis to make sure that my settings and are in a place where if I lose something or something gets corrupt, I can just reinstall and I'm pretty much good to go. Now, the next piece of software that I had to install this night of long nights of software was OpenOffice. I was actually in OpenOffice. I was working on a document, and I got a little pop-up that said, oh, hey, there's a new version to update. So I said, all right, I will download the new update. And I clicked on the download update icon from within the open document. And God almighty, that was a big old fucking mistake. For whatever reason, the download took forever. I mean, I'm talking hours and hours to get to like 14% of the download. And I mean, I have a very fast high-speed cable connection. I know OpenOffice is kind of a large file, but, you know, 4 hours for 14%, that's just ridiculous. So I decided to kill the download, and I just got the update from OpenOffice itself, which is www.openoffice.org, and I downloaded the most recent version of OpenOffice, which I'm trying to see if I can figure out what that is as we speak here. See, now I'm alt-tabbing using my desktops to jump over to my other page here that has all my things to load here. Looks like it's OpenOffice, it's version 3.2 is the most current version of OpenOffice. So that's what I was downloading. If you don't know what OpenOffice is, it's a free open source alternative to Microsoft Office. It does Word documents, spreadsheets, PowerPoints. It does everything that Office does. OpenOffice does it as well. And the nice thing is that, you know, it wants the default to save things in the OpenOffice file format. But besides offering you just the OpenOffice format, it offers you, oh God almighty, it's something like 10, 15 different other formats that you can save your document in. So, you know, I set my default to save as a Word document. I think it's like a, you know, I don't use the new Word format, the XML format. I use the one before that, which is, let me see what that is here. I can't remember what that is. I think it's the Word 97-2000 XP.doc format. That's what I've been using. And you can change it to any number of different formats here. I'm just going to take a quick peek here. You can use the ODF format, which is the Open Office, I believe. You can do a Word 95. You can do a Word 6.0. You can do rich text. You can do StarWriter. You can do a text. You can do a text encoded. You can do HTML, or you can do Word 2003 XML. So there's a variety of formats that you can choose from. And again, the same thing with the PDF and the Excel. I mean, it'll save it in multiple versions of that are out there that could possibly be used by any number of people that are out there. So more than likely, there's going to be a version that will be compatible with the software that you have and that your friends have. Now, the next piece of software that I'm going to be discussing is called Duplicate Cleaner. And I'm not going to give out the URL because I'm not going to recommend it, but I want to talk about it because it disappointed me, to say the very least. One of the things I was doing this one long night was clean up my MP3 collection. I think I had recently had to re-import my music library into iTunes, and God almighty, if I didn't have 7, 8, 9 versions of the same song, not every song, but there were enough songs that had the same multiple versions of the same song, the same length, the same number of kilobits. I mean, everything was exactly the same. And I was just getting tired of trying to manually go through my folders to get rid of all these duplicates. So I was kind of cruising around online, and I came across Duplicate Cleaner, which is supposed to find duplicates on your hard drive. Now, it'll do MP3s, I believe it also does photos and other things, but I honestly don't know, because I uninstalled it, because it just didn't really work all that well. I had to run it multiple times for it to find all the duplicates on my hard drive. It was just going through one folder. There's probably, let me take a quick peek here. How many files do I have in my, let's see. I've got almost 4,600 MP3s in my music collection, and that doesn't include podcasts, which are probably right about the same number. So maybe, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 total files to look through, but it was all in one folder. It wasn't like you had to go through multiple folders and compare one folder to the other. You just had to look through one folder and look for duplicates within that one folder. And, like I said, I had to run it, I'm going to say, at least 8 or 9 times before I finally felt like, okay, I think it found everything. And even then, it didn't find everything. And even after that, I had to go in and actually manually delete things. So I really cannot recommend Duplicate Cleaner. If you're looking for something to look for duplicates, whether MP3s or images or whatever, I would find something else other than Duplicate Cleaner. It just did not seem to do the job, and I can't recommend it at all. Now, the last piece of software that I want to talk about is a little ditty called CCleaner. I run CCleaner after I finish doing all of my installations and my uninstallations of all these different pieces of software, and you can find that at www.piriform.com/CCleaner. That's CCLEANER. And I use CCleaner for their registry cleaning tools. It removes unused and old entries to your registry, including old and unnecessary file extensions, ActiveX controls, class IDs, program IDs, uninstallers, shared DLLs, fonts, help files, application paths, icons, and invalid shortcuts, just to name a few. It'll also clean out your Internet Explorer and Firefox temporary files, the history, and the cookies. It's a very small download, 3 megabytes, and then you just you download it, you install it. I get a UAC warning saying, hey, do you want to allow this program to make changes? I just select yes, and then it pretty much goes from there. I really use it for the registry cleaning tools. I don't use it as a performance enhancer. I don't know that really cleaning the registry really gives you any gain in speed or performance. I just like to clean up my registry and get rid of all the junk that doesn't need to be there. I think it do miracles on people's machines where, there's just something in the registry that's pointing somewhere that just is pointing to nowhere. And as soon as you remove that whatever it is, you know, the PC comes back to life. Now, you know, before you run the registry cleaner, it asks you if you want to create a backup of registry. I always do that. I always save that to an external hard drive because, well, fuck knows that if you do something really screwy to your registry that you probably won't be able to get back into it, to, you know, to your PC to the point of where maybe you can't actually get to that save registry file. You know, it's nice to have it on the external drive, just, you know, so, you know, that way you can, if once you get into it, it's there, and you can just, you know, run the CCleaner again and have it fix the registry back to the way it was, and you should be good to go. So, you know, I've seen CCleaner clean out, I mean, just all kinds of files and crap and crud, and I really like it more for the registry cleaning purpose as opposed to performance gains that may or may not actually happen by cleaning your registry. Now that I have gone through all of the software that I installed and tried out, the last thing that I actually did, it was kind of a situation where I save a lot of things to my desktop just for quick storage, and then once I store it there, I dump it into another folder somewhere else, and I go from there. So just, you know, a lot of default downloads go to my desktop. And I was trying to download something, and I don't remember exactly what it was, and I got a Windows message saying that the file couldn't be downloaded because there wasn't enough space for the file on my C drive. The way I set up my PC is I have one hard drive that I dedicate solely to my OS, and antivirus, and just things that just will not install anywhere else other than the C drive. And then I have another drive that's just for applications, and I have another drive that's just for data, and then I have a backup drive. So my OS drive is a 74 gigabyte Western Digital Raptor. It's one of the bad as fucking hell 10,000 RPM SATA drives. And, you know, the size is small, 74 gigabytes, but when you're only putting in your OS and, you know, maybe an antivirus and, you know, like I said, just other things that just will not install anywhere else, 74 gigabytes is just fine. So I pull up my computer and I look at my C drive. It said I was 6 gigabytes away from filling the drive. So I'm like, 68 gigabytes. I'm like, okay, Windows 7 installations, maybe 4 or 5 gigs. I've got antivirus on there. Like, I'm trying to mentally do the math here. Like, okay, there should be way more fucking space on this drive. So what I had actually done was, you know, I knew I could have Googled this and probably gotten the answer. But I actually emailed Paul Thurrott, who I spoke about on episode 1 of the Dow of Tech podcast. I listened to Paul Thurrott's show with Leo Laporte, Windows Weekly. And I emailed Paul Thurrott onto his website, which is the Win Supersite. So it's www.winsupersite.com. And I emailed him and I said, you know, hey, you know, I've got this problem. My hard drive seems pretty full. I've only got an OS on there and a couple other things. I'm not really sure what's going on. And I had mentioned to him that I had multiple folders that just seemed odd. I had program files and program files by 86. And then I had program files .old and then program files by 86.old. And then I had program files .old 2 and program files by 86.old.2. And I had, you know, three or four different listings for these program files folders, both the program files and the program files by 86. Paul was kind enough to email me back, and he told me that apparently when you do an installation of Windows 7 over an existing installation, Windows creates these folders saving the data from the old installation. And it names these folders Program Files Old and Program Files by 86 Old. I guess the idea is that if you're doing a reinstallation, maybe there's something that you possibly need from the old install that didn't carry over or whatever else, and so the data is saved for you. But if you don't need it, it's just taking up space. So Paul was kind enough to send me over to a Microsoft support site, and it told me the steps on how to get rid of these old folders and the data. If you are doing the exact same thing, you can go to http://support.microsoft.com/kb/933212. And this article will give you the full details as to how to remove these .old folders. By the time I got finished removing these .old folders, I gained basically half of my hard drive space left. I'm trying to think exactly. Well, here, let's take a peek here. Like I said, I had 68 gigabytes used at that particular point in time. I have 37 gigabytes free out of the 74 that I had before. So I gained quite a bit of hard drive space back by removing these .old folders. So I guess the lesson that I have learned here is that if you're doing a full reinstallation of Windows 7 and you have no desire to keep anything from your old installation, you really should do a full fucking format on the hard drive before you do the installation. I was under the impression that when I did the install of Windows 7 that I was doing a full format, but I guess I was wrong. And what I'm thinking is that I had probably installed the Windows 7 release candidate probably three or four times on that hard drive. So the .old files are probably going back to the original release candidate, which I probably installed twice, and the RC1, which again I probably installed twice. So, you know, to have that many .old folders made sense. So if you're doing a reinstall of Windows 7, definitely do a full backup before you actually do the reinstall, or else you're going to be wasting a whole bunch of time deleting and removing that .old folder. So that is going to do it for episode number 2 of the Dow of Tech, One Long Night. Before we go, just wanted to say a couple things, a couple shout-outs. Wanted to say thank you to the people that make Audacity, the recording software that I am using to make this podcast. If you have any interest in doing any audio recording, I highly recommend going to http://audacity.sourceforge.net and download Audacity for free. Works on 32-in 64-bit machines. The intro and outro music were both grabbed from podsafeaudio.com. The intro music is called Schrodinger's Cat Paradox by C-Jax. The closing music is called Anhelos, the remastered version by Leechmaster. Also, if you like what you hear with the Dow of Tech, please follow me on Twitter. I am twitter.com @MarkPrestash, MarkPrestash. My Twitter feed is more of a live stream than just a straight-up tech-type thing. I do a lot of tech stuff on there, things that I'm doing, questions, whatever that I have going on. But just as often as you may get the tech stuff, you may get something about my kids or my wife or something else that's going on in my life. So just be aware of that the Twitter stream is, like I said, more of a live stream than actually a straight-up tech thing. If you have any comments, whether they be positive or negative or concerns or questions, feel free to drop me a line. You can email me at taospotting@gmail.com. That's taospotting@gmail.com. All right, folks, that's going to do it for episode 2 of the Dow of Tech. Thank you for listening, and until next time, have a good one. Talk to you all later. Bye.